Hello everyone and welcome to today's episode of the Northern Rugby Podcast with myself, Darren Beck, and my co-host Pete Newbegin. On today's episode, we're very excited to bring you our discussion with former Leeds and Yorkshire Carnegie number 8, Ollie Steadman. Ollie also represented Newcastle Falcons, Doncaster Knights and the Ealing Trailfinders during his career, as well as having a spell in the Premiership with London Welsh, and also representing England in age group rugby all the way through to the under-20s. We chat with Ollie about his early days in rugby with Leeds Carnegie, his disappointment at being released upon their relegation to the Championship, and then having to find his way back into professional rugby with Newcastle Falcons via a spell of Tynedale Rugby Club. Ollie also talks to us about being promoted with London Welsh, why he thinks the Championship is significantly weaker without the playoff system, and he also gives us his thoughts on potential ring fencing as well. We also get to hear about Ollie's time in the England age group setup and what it was like coming through with future British and Irish Lions such as the Vunipola Brothers, George Ford, Owen Farrell and Elliot Daly. So let's get straight into the conversation and hear what Ollie had to say.
Hello.
Hi, mate. Hi.
Good stuff. So, welcome along. So you're the very first guest of the Northern Rugby Podcast. So thanks very much for popping on.
Cheers. Thanks. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me, guys.
Good stuff. So I thought the best place to start would just be chat us through this season, obviously how it started, how it's progressed and everything that's happened with Doncaster and the injury, and then what's really happened since the whole coronavirus hit.
Yeah, so this season's been probably the most difficult one of my career to date, to be honest. To go back to the end of last season, the second last or third last game of last season, I did a PCL tear in my knee and was out over all of the off season. Lucky didn't have to have surgery and got back for the start of the season. So that put me on a little bit of a back foot going into the season. Only got maybe 2 or 3 weeks of actual training, full training in before the season started. And then unfortunately I got banned first game of the season for a location, which obviously wasn't the best.
I think one
here
about the
old location. it's one of the one of those things where someone falls into your fist accidentally. Yeah, exactly. So unfortunately got a little banned for that and then came back. Season was a bit hit and miss for myself and for Doncaster as a club. We kind of struggled to find form. I think it was a difficult year in terms of a lot of personnel upheaval and changing of staff and managers and then changing of staff halfway through pre-season again. So it was quite a difficult one. And then so eventually got through, sort of started getting into the season. And in January or start of February, I played away at Ampto and unfortunately essentially snapped my ankle, four ligaments in my ankle and a fracture in the bottom of my shin, which was difficult to take, obviously, when a season's been a bit stop-start and not gone as well as you'd like to, I think. Getting injured is always a frustrating time, so I'd had surgery on my ankle on the Thursday, and then came in on the Monday or Tuesday next week just to get some bandages and strapping changed, and unfortunately Doncaster saw fit to hand me my notice and activated my injury clause, even though I still had sort of 17 months left on the contract. And so sort of since then, it's all been a bit up in the air, a bit crazy. Obviously then COVID has hit, which has made things even more crazy in the rugby world. And so now I'm kind of at the situation where I'm looking more towards the future and future careers than staying in full-time rugby.
Just going back to the injury clause, Ollie, is that something that you specifically had in your contract or is that something that everybody has?
I believe everyone has it in Premiership and Championship. I believe the Premiership 6 months, which allows a little bit more time recovery for things. And unless you've got a sort of major ACL injury, then usually you should be back within that period. So it's any six months out of a 12-month period, which is aggregate, so it could be in different chunks and different amounts. But unfortunately, the Championship is 3 months, which personally, in my opinion, I think it's disgusting. I think it's a bit of an underhand tactic for coaches and managers and probably more the senior board and directors of the club to get out of situations that you often see them towards the end of the season when clubs are struggling financially, they start activating injury clauses. And my personal belief is if you ask a man to go and put his body on the line for you, wearing your shirt, I think you should look after him and honour the contract. That sort of honour and respect is expected of every player
yep.
to honour their contract. I think it should be a two-way thing, but unfortunately, not every championship club sees fit. Most of them, to be fair to most clubs, they do look after their boys, and when there's long-term injuries, they do tend to look after them. But unfortunately, not every other club has that level of respect for their players.
And I'd read an interview that you did with Talking Rugby Union, where you mentioned the potential move to France had fallen through.
Yeah, so basically part of the whirlwind of a season. I'd agreed to move out to France, and unfortunately the plug was pulled. The club said sort of due to finances, but it was a bit of a weird one. So I was due to fly out, I think, 5 days later, and that all got pulled, which is a bit of an ongoing legal discussion at the minute. So it's been a pretty disappointing 12 months, and yeah, it's been very tough sort of emotionally and mentally, and also then trying to get fit and with COVID and everything that's happening around the world at the minute. Contracts in rugby, just like every other job market, is suffering hugely, and you only got to see the wage cuts everyone's having to take across the board, nearly reductions in salary cap. There's not much free money. People are unsure when seasons are going to begin. I know the Premiership's coming back, but there's no sort of definite answer on when next season will start. And it's a bit of a difficult time to be in employment anywhere in any industry, but rugby and sort of entertainment industries are getting hit harder than most.
And with that being the case, how heavily are you pursuing rugby for next season?
I mean, I think you've always got to keep your ears open for things. You have agents sort of call and say it could be options here and options there. But being a realist as well, I think rugby in the UK, if you're not in the Premiership for next season, will be a very, very different outlook on the way it's going to be. I think contracts, for boys who are out of contract this summer, there probably couldn't have been a worse summer to be out of contract. So I think it's going to be very difficult to get a contract that would be at the wage expectations you had previously. I think in the Championship, the sort of fortunate few who were earning a decent wage will be hit hardest, obviously. People look to make cutbacks, and high earners or higher earners are the easiest people to make cutbacks from. So I think the UK obviously is a very difficult climate. I mean, I've still got my ears to the ground. I've got a few different options, a few semi-professional options that could be very interesting. But yeah, I'm kind of looking more towards the future and maybe supplement some rugby in between that.
Good stuff. Well, we'll get away from the current year, which has been a bit grim for everybody, I think. We'll go back to the start of your career. So tell us about starting out with, was it Carnegie, your very first club?
Yeah, so I sort of came into rugby sort of differently. Rugby was never really a priority of mine growing up. I mean, I grew up in the Northeast, grew up in South Shields, and the Northeast, it was football. Everything was football, football, football. The schools I went to were quite pro rugby, but still every kid in the street wants to play football. So I wasn't really that interested. And then got to sort of 16, 17, and rugby sort of took off a little bit from nowhere. And in the end, ended up going down to Leeds at the time, which was a real sort of interesting place to be, an exciting place to be. Obviously, Stuart Lancaster just sort of left the academy, moved on to the first team, and Leeds and Yorkshire as an area was kind of the hotbed of producing talent for the future at the time. So I made the decision to go down there and join the academy. It was Dick and Edwards and Mark Loughton at the time, and Leeds were sort of littered with junior England internationals, 16s, 18s, 20s. The senior side had just won the Power Gen Cup, so it was an interesting time to get involved, and definitely an exciting time.
And did you break into the Carnegie first team right away?
So my first 2 years I'd have been in the academy, I was still at school, so I was going to school in Tynemouth at King's. So I was kind of playing Monday night A-League games and then coming back and sort of flicking in between the two, doing the occasional session, sort of going down in like holidays and what have you to get whatever sort of first team stuff I could get in or academy stuff. And then from leaving school, went into the first team environment. And so, yeah, it was a difficult time in terms of we were down the bottom of the Premiership, having just come up from promotion. So we were sort of struggling. And I think it was a very different philosophy back then in terms of promoting youth, which you see sort of now. Clubs give kids a chance across the board nearly, and sort of in that era under Neil Back and Andy Key, it wasn't the most easy situations to give kids a chance. Yeah. So I didn't make my debut until the following season. I got put out on loan at Otley, which was good. Some valuable lessons learned there, as did a lot of the academy boys. I think we had sort of 13 of the academy boys were on loan at Otley any one time. So it was a team sort of stacked with junior players under 19s, and you kind of learn the hard way of playing men's rugby.
Yeah.
And a few tough lessons on the way. We got a few kick-ins, as you'd expect, and then sort of started making way into the first team.
Good stuff. And me and Pete managed to find an article about your first England under 20 squad,
mm-hmm.
Which is, it's incredible looking back now, because most of these players... are superstar names today. So what was it like being in that squad?
Obviously at the time you don't really think about it, but I think for my age group, from 16s, 18s, 20s, I think we lost one game in, that'd been 4 years. We probably played 20 or 30 matches, including like under 19s, playing against sort of Wales under 20s and under 20s age group. We still won. I was probably one of the worst players in the squad, but compared to some of the boys, who are full England internationals now, Billy and Mako and Owen Farrell, George Ford, Elliot Daly, Jamie Joseph, Johnny Johnson, sorry, there's loads of them. It was pretty ridiculous array of talent.
Could you tell then that they were going to be the players that they are now?
The majority of them, when Billy and Mako rock up at 140 kilos and throwing 16-year-old boys and 18-year-old boys around, you could always tell they were going to be pretty special. We were 18. At 16, George Ford came into the 18 squad and was probably the best player in the squad straight away. Was supremely talented. All the boys had gone on. You could tell from day one they had the sort of the it factor and were definitely going to be special.
Yeah. And then how did the move back to the northeast from Carnegie come about?
Now, so it was a weird one. So Leeds got relegated and sort of made cutbacks everywhere. And unfortunately, I was one of the ones who didn't get kept on. So I was a bit unsure about what I was going to do, whether that's going to be rugby or just general life. So I actually went across to Australia to play for 6 months. I had a call off a mate who's an Aussie, came over here and had gone back and sort of said, do you fancy a bit of fun playing rugby over there. So as a sort of 20, 21-year-old does, you just pack your bags and give it a go. And so I played for Southern Districts over there and was going really well. Fortunately, picked up a little injury and kind of been in discussions with various people and they sort of said, well, I think the best idea would be to come home. So I came home just to get fit, played for Tynedale for a few weeks. And obviously, Dino's a regular down in Tynedale, went over his neck of the woods. So got chat with Dino and then eventually signed to come back to Falklands. So there's a bit of an interesting one going sort of having been grew up in the northeast and then having gone away and then eventually get my opportunity to come back.
Yeah, well, from my accent, if you can't tell, I'm not a native Newcastle boy, but Pete is.
No.
He's a lifelong Newcastle fan, so I'll let him talk through the next because he recalls that season that you were there. He was in the stands.
The championship. It was a championship winning season. There was some incredible players in that squad as well. I mean, you had the likes of Jimmy Gopeth was there and he was pulling the strings every week. You had the likes of Ali Hogg as well in the forwards. Rory Lawson was there as well. So talk about that and going into the Falcons setup and sort of having that taste of professional rugby with all those guys. What was that like?
Yeah, it was a great opportunity. I think coming back and playing for your sort of home clubs is always adds a little bit extra incentive. And I mean, the squad was sort of supremely talented with internationals dotted everywhere and And then sort of the young lads who'd come through are now established sort of first teamers like Welshy and Mark Wilson, who were knocking on the door of sort of England selection. And obviously Mark eventually getting there. I mean, probably as strong a squad as I think the Championship's ever seen, maybe until Sarri's come down this year. And I mean, playing with those guys made life pretty easy. Because like no teams were worried about what I was going to do when you've got 10 internationals on the pitch. So it kind of made life, yeah, I doubt I was very high on the priority list of anyone. So
So what were
made
your
life a little bit
highlights
easier.
of that season? Because I mean, there was fantastic games. It was the British and Irish Cup final as well, which has narrowly got pipped by Leinster on that one, and the semi-finals against Leeds, where you know there were times where Falcons actually thought, you know, there's a chance that we might not actually go through to the final because of the playoff systems at the time, and you know how well Leeds played down at Headingley. So what were your sort of experiences of that season, especially sort of towards the tail with the cup final and the playoffs? Was it, you know, was it as high pressured as it you know, as you anticipate?
I think the cup final was obviously a bit of a disappointment losing to Leinster. And I remember when obviously went to extra time, and then we were sort of thinking, this could this go to like penalty shootouts here,
Yeah,
or
I remember that as
who's
well. I remember it being freezing cold and
Yeah, it was
just watching
bolting,
the
and
game finished.
it was mid-May as well, and it was freezing. So
Yeah.
typical Kingston Park. But no, it was obviously interesting, and I think we'd gone the whole season unbeaten, and then I think we lost second last day of season or last day of season at Bristol, which was the first loss of the season. Which I think, I mean, going unbeaten is fantastic, but also I think sometimes people forget that losing does happen, and obviously when you're on a roll, I think it can have a sort of adverse effect. And I mean, I don't think it did on the squad by any stretch of the imagination, but then Leeds sort of rocked up and gave a real stern test, and actually weren't too far off at times. A couple of key moments and swings in the game could have been a very different outcome.
Yeah,
But
I mean,
it
you look at that Leinster game, and it's some of the players playing. You know, you've got Luke McGrath, you've got Dominic Ryan, Geordie Murphy, Fionn Carr. There was some cracking players playing, and obviously the British and Irish Cup sort of ceased to exist, and you know, sort of moving on to that. What was your sort of preference? Would it be the Championship Cup, or was it actually playing these sort of young lads from the likes of Leinster, Munster, couple of the Welsh sides as well? You know, what was your preference of the two?
Personally, I think the Championship Cup is absolutely nonsense the way its current format is. I think just playing a League Cup when teams have already played each other, I don't think there's any real desire for teams to win it. Obviously, teams want to go out and they want to win individual fixtures, but I don't think any teams target the cup as a key thing to win. Whereas when it was this old format with sort of British and Irish, the Welsh teams would be fanatical about
Yeah,
it. I mean,
yeah.
when I went to London Welsh, we played at Pontypridd, and there must have been 6,000 there. And it's like everyone from that valley and the next valley and the valley after that
Yeah.
turned up. And then you obviously go across to Ireland, you play against sort of the regional A sides who are very strong. As you said there, like the conveyor belt coming off at Leinster was international, future international after future international. And I think it gave a bit of impetus to the competition, and also a bit of a level and a bit of a reality check when you would go to these random clubs in Wales and Scotland that weren't professional. They weren't the best facilities necessarily. They weren't big grounds, big fans, but they had a group of lads, 15 lads and 23 lads who wanted to mix it with you, and especially when you went to Wales, wanted to take your head off half the time. It wasn't a nice friendly welcome, and we'll all try and get on it. There was a couple of punch ups, and it used to get
Old
serious.
school
So
rugby.
I think, yeah, old school rugby, and I mean, I think that's a great leveler. These teams probably couldn't, well, definitely couldn't beat a team like Newcastle playing sort of modern fancy rugby. So they make things as hard as they can and as difficult as they can, and try and make it competitive, which was good. I think especially as a young lad, or for a lot of young lads who haven't played a great deal of men's rugby, I think it was a sharp wake-up call to this is reality. Reality is not always playing on a lovely
Yeah, exactly.
surface in the Premier League
So
or yeah, where people yeah. respect you.
So moving forward, I mean, you know, there's always been talk about having, going back to the days, like the Power Gen Cup days, where you have sides from maybe National One competing against Championship sides. Because, I mean, I'm sure you'd get some incredible games there with sides having, you know, having a big side like a Doncaster or a London Scottish coming to town. It would really make a sort of massive day for those clubs as well. Would that be something that you would sort of be interested in seeing in the future, seeing these cup competitions, see more sort of semi-professional to sort of amateur clubs play? Because I know Rugby League do it, which is sees a few surprises. Would that be something you'd be interested in seeing?
Yeah, definitely. I remember sort of going down to my local club, which is Westo, and at the time the Power Gen Cup was a tiered system, so I think Westo, we were probably bloody Northumberland Durham 1 or something quite low, maybe North East 1, and ended up on a cup run, played against Wharfdale, yeah. played against Richmond, played against Loughborough Students, who were two or three leagues above us. We beat two out of three of them. I think it was a great, like, it's like a bit of FA Cup. It gets a sort of romanticism out of rugby fans. I think I would actually take it a step further. If I was in charge of the RFU, which is way above my pay grade, but if I was, I would get rid of the LV Cup and I'd make the A League, I'd make the LV Cup an A League and Championship Cup, and I would sort of say to the Premiership teams that it's obviously a chance to rest your sort of top stars, but after your best 15 or 20 players, then your sort of the second tier of your squad has to go and compete against Championship sides, which inevitably the sort of team's promotion might rotate a bit. But I think it'd be an interesting yardstick to see where the level of the Championship is compared to the Premiership and sort of those Premiership squad
it's
players.
Definitely, it's a great payday as well if you have a Harlequins or a Saracens or a Sale or Bristol coming to a Richmond or London Scottish or Ampt Hill. It's obviously a great payday.
Yeah.
And it gets them on the map as well, the rugby map. You know, I remember when the Falcons won the Power Gen Cup back in, was it 2004? We played Pimpton Bees in the semi-final and they'd beaten Wasps in the round before. And that was huge.
Yeah.
That was one of the biggest surprises Premiership or professional rugby's ever seen. I remember it being a huge thing, yeah. And you know that was brilliant to see.
Yeah, I mean, a Wasp of that generation would have been an England star-studded side, who might have been rested. I'm not sure, but the next tier of players would have still been considered very strong. And I think it'd be a very interesting match if we sort of took those top 15 players out of a Premiership side and put sort of the next best players in against fully strong, full strength Championship sides as to whether they would win. I'm sure, I mean, a lot of teams would still win games. However, I don't think it'd be as one-sided as someone might imagine. I think also for the fans getting out and going to these local grounds and going down to the Wreck at Richmond or these type of places that aren't as like plush and polished, but have a level of endearment, and you go into Richmond, have a few beers. I think for the rugby fan, that'd be a fantastic day out and a fantastic idea. However, whether the RFU will do that because they don't particularly like funding the Championship, I'm not sure they would ever consider that.
Well, Ollie, given that you've spent quite a bit of time in the Championship over the past 5 years and you've kind of seen the transition from the kind of playoff days to what it is now, do you think that's a good move or a bad move? Did you prefer the playoffs?
I think there's two sides, but I think if a team wins every game in the season, they deserve to go up on merit, which is, I can understand why the club coming down would feel very aggrieved about having to go into a playoff. However, I think the removal of the playoff system has actually killed the league. So, for example, I think Falcons beat Ealing this year just before Christmas. I think it's the last game before Christmas. That was the end of the Championship season because it'd been through a full round of fixtures. I think it was 12 games in or 13 games in. Falcons hadn't lost a game. They'd beaten their next closest rival. It was very, very unlikely Falcons were ever going to lose a game. So therefore, as a competition, it's over. For the bottom two or three sides, they're still looking over their shoulders and thinking, we need to stay up. But then sort of the next six to eight sides, there's nothing to play for. And I think in my experience, when it was down to playoffs. For example, at Falcons, Bristol beat us last day of the season. Had a result gone in their favour, they could have gone from fifth or sixth to fourth and snuck in the playoffs. London Scottish had snuck in the playoffs before Rotherham had done as well. So it kept the league competitive the whole way through. And I think also for the big clubs, it's a bit of a leveler because, I mean, the club coming down's funding is, I don't know, I think 6 or 7 times more than every other league play team in the league. So it kept them a little bit honest as well, the chance that this isn't actually going to be plain sailing. If you look at Bristol for years, had funding, had the budget, had everything, had a lot of investment and couldn't get out of the league. Worcester spent two years in the league because of playoffs. I think for the fan and for the neutral, I think playoffs were fantastic. You saw sort of playing in those games, attendances doubled, if not more. There was a real buzz about it. Sky TV were more involved, or whichever broadcaster would buy the rights would be more involved. And I think it gave something to play for, whereas now the championship essentially is decided before the season even starts. In all reality, no team's ever going to come down that'll be that weak. They're not going to win the league,
Well,
which is
I
a
mean,
shame.
you've got the experience of both kind of ways because that Newcastle team kind of walked the league, but as Pete said, they struggled in the playoffs and almost lost to Leeds. And then I believe it was the next season you went to London Welsh and did Bristol win the league that year? But you obviously won the playoffs.
Yeah, I think Bristol pipped us at the end of the season for the league, sort of the league leaders award. But then I think we played them, might have played them last game of the season or second last game. Beat us at Ashton Gate. Oh no, Ashton Gate would be still the Memorial Ground. And then obviously the playoffs came. I think Rotherham, they beat Rotherham quite comfortably, I believe. I think it was Rotherham. And then we played them at home first round because they got the choice of home or away. And we're to be honest, pretty confident, I think. I think Andy Robinson was pretty confident that it'd be a repeat of what happened 3 weeks beforehand. And they got a bit of a surprise. I think still going into the second leg, a lot of the pundits and people in the sort of knowledge of rugby were saying, I'm sure Bristol have got enough to overturn this, which they probably should have on paper because they had a lot of players, a lot of money, a lot of quality there. But sport isn't always played on paper, and it actually was a bit of an underdog story and one sort of for the neutral and for the fan to go, how well, fantastic's that, seeing sort of the minnows beat the sort of the
Yeah,
big club.
absolutely. And our old mate Tom May was your captain that year, is that right?
He was indeed, yeah. Tommy was our captain, did a fantastic job. Don't always better his captaincy, always permanent tan because the guy is always glowing, always bronze. He likes looking after the rig, so fair play to him.
So you had some brilliant players in that London Welsh squad when you got promoted. You had Piri Wepu as well. What was that like playing with him? Because he'd have been a World Cup winner when he arrived at you guys.
I think it was an interesting situation at London Welsh, obviously, where the season, I think that year went on later than any season they went on. I think we didn't finish till the second week of June or something crazy, which once you've given the boys sort of 4 or 5 weeks off to recover after, I think we were in our 54th week of the season from when we came back to pre-season. So ridiculously long season, which playoffs always bought. But I mean, it's kind of one of those things you got a squad, you have to sort of put up with it. I think we only did 3 weeks of pre-season and then we're straight into friendlies and straight into season. So it was a very tough period to manage. We lost a few boys going up, which obviously in hindsight was massively to the detriment of the squad, I think. One thing that, well, Welsh sort of had the year we camped was a brilliant sense of camaraderie and a brilliant sense of we were sort of like the scruffy bunch. We were the sort of undesirables who all stuck together. And made something happen. I think it's very easy as a coach to sort of not get starry-eyed, but you see sort of big names and players who've got X, Y, and Z on their resume, and it's very easy to go down that route and say, well, on paper it works, it'll work on a pitch. I think we're obviously coupled in with a short pre-season, not the biggest budget by any stretch of the imagination. Sort of big turnover of players, it was quite difficult. But obviously, some of the players he brought in, like Piri, wasn't anywhere near at his best, and wasn't the player he once was, which I'm sure he'd be the first to admit. But when you walk in a change room, you see a World Cup winner who's won World Cups, and I mean, played at nine for the All Blacks and played at 10 and kicked goals. You sort of go, oh, this guy's a bit different. And as I say, even though he wasn't in the condition that he'd like to be in, the sort of level he'd like to be at, I mean, he still had a few things he could learn, so a few tricks up his sleeve.
Good stuff. Was that the season? Did you guys have to relocate that year as well, or had that already happened?
It was kind of ongoing. It was so it happened this sort of the season I was at Newcastle. They just relocated to the Kazam, and in principle, the idea looked a fantastic one because that sort of Oxfordshire area is a bit of a black spot. There's not too much football there. Obviously, there's Oxford United, but no sort of really big clubs to challenge you. There's not much rugby there in terms of big professional clubs. And I think the idea on paper looked a really good one. But I think, obviously, where they went to Coventry and kind of stuck between the two. I think having a foot in either camp didn't quite work. I think it was either they had to be all in and say training ground, stadium, everything. We're relocating a whole lot up there and investing and making it work, or just say, actually, we're going to stay in London and look at alternatives around London. Because I don't, you guys have been to Aldo Park. Aldo Park, as endearing, as sort of charismatic as it is, it's not a place you can play Premiership rugby. I mean, it's weird. I actually really like playing there. There's something about it. And it's when you get all the old Welsh boys and the choirs there. And it is very endearing. But, I mean, going forward, it's not sustainable for Premiership rugby. And I think the club sort of got caught in between two minds, and it's difficult to balance both.
So, moving on from London Welsh, I think you went back to Doncaster for a while, you were back to Carnegie for a while, and you wind up at Ealing.
Yeah, went to Ealing, yeah.
And how much belief was there in Ealing that they could actually come up to the Premiership? Because they seemed to be spending an awful lot of money.
Ealing's it's a difficult club, I'd say, because whilst obviously there's great financial backing there and the owner's very, very invested in the whole idea of Premiership rugby, I'm not sure I fundamentally believe the whole club is on the same path at the time. I think obviously when I signed there, I went halfway through the season with Leeds sort of starting to collapse, and Alex Codlin was a sort of fantastic coach, and he was, in my opinion, the one who was really pushing that idea of Premiership rugby. And unfortunately, he left the first week of the following pre-season to go to Harlequins, which you can't blame a man for taking a better job and a higher opportunity. I think from there, I think the sort of ambition, personally for me, if I'm going to put my hat on the line, I think I don't think Ben Wards really wants to go up. I think there's one thing saying I want to be in the Premiership, and then there's another thing actually doing it. Because Ealing over the last couple of years have had a fantastic squad. You see some of the players that come across, people like Geordie Reid, who's played Super Rugby caps, Andrew Giotello, played in World Cups. There's some fantastic players there, but I question whether the club, not the players, I think the players fundamentally do. I think every player wants to play at the highest level they can, but whether the club actually really want to go up, or is it easy being the sort of the also-rans and finishing second, winning 90% of your games, maybe winning a cup along the way and saying, well, that's a pat on the back because the team coming down got a bigger budget, they've got more of everything, their Premiership club. I think it's very easy to sort of say, well, we give it a good go, but it's not enough.
I thought, because the season that London Irish came down and we were in the Championship, Ealing pushed them very, very close, and I thought for a while Ealing could actually do it.
Yeah, I mean, as I say, there's some good players there. If you look at the number of players who go on up to the Premiership sides, there's definitely that ability there. But a question coming from the top, whether there's the belief of this is going to be a Premiership club. Because obviously, I mean, it's all well and good saying it, but the levels of investment needed, once you're in the Premiership, probably go up 2, 3, 4 times. Levels of infrastructure needed, the level of staffing needed, the size of squad, levels of squad. It's a very hard job, and you've seen the sort of clubs that have come up, apart from Exeter, none of the Championship clubs have been able to break into the league and break the mould. London Welsh tried it, and obviously, like, sort of the situation the club's found itself in now. So I think it's very much a risk and reward type thing, and obviously a very difficult arrangement to get through.
So, Ollie, tell us a bit more about what's your favourite rugby memory. It could be playing at Kings in Tynemouth. It could be playing in the Premiership for the for Welsh or going up with the Falcons. So, what's your favourite rugby memory that sticks in your mind?
Oh Jesus! Favorite memory. It's been a few. I mean, starting off rugby, I first went to Durham School. Playing at sort of a historic school was fantastic. That's where I kind of found a bit of love for rugby. Making my first team debut at Leeds, even though we got absolutely pumped at Cleffley, like 50-5, was good. I mean, I think we had a 7-hour bus home, and I wasn't allowed to sit down for the whole 7 hours. So that's another. I think we'd been pre-made little shepherd's pies that were sort of made by the chef, and we had a small oven in the on the bus, and they could only fit in two at a time. And so I did, well, 23 players plus travelling reserves plus probably did nearly 40 shepherd's pies, which took me most of the trip home to heat them up and dish them out to the boys, as the young lads had to do back then. Making coffees and doing Lord knows what. Obviously playing England junior Patriots, playing 18s and 20s was pretty proud moments. Obviously signing back at Falcons was pretty big for me in terms of just personal. Obviously coming back and playing at home, and your friends and family all from the area, your mates where you grew up. I mean, the only rugby club I ever watched, well, a handful of times professionally growing up, was Falcons. So that was a big one. Obviously winning the championship. I think winning the championship with Welsh the second year round was probably a little bit more special, just because
Falcons,
beat Bristol, but I mean, Falcons, it was expected. I mean, Bedford, whilst they give it a good go, should have never really been able to match us over two legs. But obviously Bristol, they were expected to win. So I think the whole underdog status makes it a little bit sweeter. I'd probably say out of those sort of five or six memories, I think they're probably the ones that really sort of sit with you and sort of resonate.
Good man. Just before we move on to your ultimate 15, I want to ask you one final question. I think I know what the answer is going to be, but as ring fencing draws inevitably closer, what are your thoughts on ring fencing?
It's a difficult subject. I think I'm actually on the side of, I think it has to happen. Because I don't see a way the RFU will fund the championship properly unless Premiership Rugby becomes a separate entity and has its own funding sources. Yeah. I think, obviously, the gap between Premiership and Championship is bigger than what it was 5 years ago, 10 years ago. I don't think we'll see another Exeter coming up and repeating that feat of becoming established in the Premiership and building, and obviously within sort of 10 years they'd won a Premiership. So I don't think that'll happen again, because I think the gap financially is too big, it's too great at the minute. So I'm actually all for, I'd bring, obviously, so for next season I'd bring Saracens up, I'd potentially bring Ealing up. It would have been Leeds, obviously Leeds would have been the option had they not sort of fallen away as they had done, because I think Yorkshire definitely needs a rugby playing outlet. At the highest level, and I'd rig fence the Premiership and have it at 13 or 14, and have two similar to what Rugby League did for a couple of years, where they had a reshuffle every so often if one club was particularly struggling or financially couldn't afford to. But having ring fenced it, I would then insist that any TV deal that would be bought for Premiership Rugby, which would hopefully be greater, would include Championship. There would be a cut, any international TV deal would include the Championship, so there's greater funding there, because I think a lot of people don't see the reality of Championship Rugby, where there's huge sums of boys playing for just about minimum wage. There's huge sums of boys playing for absolutely peanuts, who are putting their bodies on the line, chasing a dream that in reality for most of them will never come, which is the nature of sport, but not getting paid for the service they're putting in, and the amount of boys you see walking away from rugby with nothing, either having had a career or having fallen along the wayside or dropped out because of injury. I don't think they're rewarded for their endeavours anywhere near enough. Obviously, there has been a few players which I've been pretty fortunate to get paid well, but a lot of boys get paid pathetic sums of money by their clubs. And I understand the clubs haven't got a bottomless pit of money But I think the RFU have to fund it properly, and the recent budget cuts, in my opinion, are disgusting. So a competitive championship is good for everyone. It's good for the Premiership. It's good for international rugby. So I'd be all for ring fencing if it meant that funding from the championship and below was done properly.
Okay. Well, I take back what I said. I didn't know what you were going to say, because I thought you'd be avidly against ring fencing, but there you go.
I wouldn't have said it 5 years ago. I definitely wouldn't have said it 5 years ago when the league was a bit stronger and teams had a bit more money. But the way, I mean, next season, probably 6 out of 12 championship clubs will be part-time. And I can only see that number increasing, which is difficult.
Right. Well, we're going to finish with your ultimate 15. So hopefully you've had a good thing about it, all those fantastic players you've played with. And you have to be in the team as well. So where would you like to put your...
Well, this is the thing, because I mean, I look very, very out of position here in terms of the players on this pitch. I don't think I deserve anywhere near to be on involved with these lot. Because I think Billy Vinopola is the best number eight in the world, I'll have to play myself at 6. So I'll let Billy play at 8 because he's pretty good, isn't he? So I'd go for my team. It's quite a tough call, actually, some of these decisions. So I went for Mako Vinopola at Loosehead. I think that kind of picks itself. There's a few other people like Johnny Golden when I went to the Falcons was fantastic. Brilliant. Brilliant player. Never got the credit deserved, actually, I don't think. And I think he got a couple of England squad call-ups and then blew out his knee.
Yeah,
he
played for Barbars in an uncapped game or something like that. But certainly deserved more.
I think he went across to Australia for the tour and got injured and just never really got the breaks he deserved, which was a massive shame. At hooker, I've gone for Andy Titterell. Played with him at Leeds and at Welsh. And, I mean, for a guy of his size to be able to compete and excel, I thought it was fantastic.
Yeah, he wouldn't have been a bad one when you're a young lad at Leeds. If you cause a bit of a friction on a pitch, not bad to have Andy Titterell backing you up, is it?
No, not at all. Andy's also a ridiculous trainer, committed to his art of being a hooker. Because probably, if you look at Andy Titterell's body shape, probably should have been a scrum half in terms of size. But, I mean, the guy did everything he could possibly do to get the most out of his career and sort of prolong what was a fantastic career. Tighthead was a difficult one. And I'm going to go with an old mate of mine, Colin Quigley, who... I actually think, well, I mean, I've seen it. I played with him firsthand. I've seen him destroy Premiership Looseheads, international Looseheads, and had his career path gone a little differently and had those opportunities. I think he would have comfortably played Premiership level, if not more. But unfortunately, sort of things maybe necessarily didn't go his way for one reason or another. But I mean, seeing him every time we play against a relegated side, he has this rule of three. It used to be where he'd get 3 carries, 3 tackles and 3 penalty scrums. So he was pretty fantastic scrummager. At lock, I went with Marco Wenzel, who was my captain at Leeds. I mean, just fantastic line-out operator. Used to even tell you that the ball was going to get thrown to him and would still beat you in the air. Always one-handed takes. Why use 2 hands when you can use one? No cameras ever take a picture of someone taking a two-handed line-out take. He's pretty special when it comes to line-outs. Other second row, I went for Joe Launchbury. Lucky enough to room with him at 20s. And, I mean, the guy didn't play 18s. So I think he was focusing on his education and sort of had forgotten about rugby and, within 2 years was playing England 20s and within 2 more years was starting for England first team, which says everything about him. He's got an absolute engine on him and big, strong man. A couple of other people probably could have got a look at. I played with Dean Schofield at Welsh and at Leeds, who was just a natural monster of a bloke. And I probably didn't get him at his best at the peak of his career coming towards the end, but it was fantastic. Obviously put myself at 6, but if I wasn't going to... I had gone with Stephen Luatua. I mean, he's tore the Premiership up, played for the All Blacks, look class in Super Rugby. I think that's pretty self-explanatory. At open side, I went with Hendry Fury, who I had at Leeds.
Probably I was going to ask you about him because he was, I mean, that season that you broke into to Leeds' side, he was absolutely incredible that year, wasn't he? And he despite getting relegated, managed to get in the England squad, which is pretty much unheard of, isn't it?
Absolutely, like, fantastic. For a guy who was playing playing loose heads in South Africa at university level, probably less than 5 years beforehand. I mean, I think Marco had to teach him how to jump in a lineup because he'd never jumped in a lineup. I mean, catch passing, like, sort of the sort of classy skills weren't necessarily a strong point, but in terms of dark arts, making 20 carries, 20 tackles a game, turnovers, strong. Hey, didn't like training, wasn't the best fitness tester by any stretch of the imagination, but you put him with a ball and when it's a battle of wills to win that ball back, I'm not sure there's been too many better at those arts than Henry was, and got beat up every single game, had a face like a butcher's block, but what he used to do on the pitch was fantastic. At number eight, I went Billy Vunipola. I mean, don't think anything needs to be said about that. Absolute man, mountain. He was a man at 15, let alone at 27 or 28 now. Nine was a tough one. Sort of had, obviously, Piri Weepu, Rory Lawson. And I actually went with Chris Cooking. And I think we had Chris at his season in the Championship with London Welsh and also played 20s with Cookie, and he was fantastic. Still is a very good player. I think he's been unlucky to be in an era of such sort of strong scrum halves for England, where sort of Danny Kerr and Ben Youngs have had the sort of position on lockdown for the last 10 years. Otherwise, I would have thought he could have been very close to getting a call-up. Dan Robson would have been also in there for me as well, potentially. At 10, it was a tough call between George Ford and Owen Farrell. I played with them both at age group level. But just going to side with Fordy, because I think Fordy's sort of skill levels are off the scale. I know Farrell internationally has done fantastic, but as an individual player, I think George Ford's brilliant.
Just 12, one quick question with George Ford. A lot of people, personality-wise, have issues with him. What was he like at that kind of age group level?
I mean, I can't comment on any of those because every time I've been around with Fordy, I came through at Leeds and Fordy was sort of coming through Leeds before he went to Leicester. I know obviously his brother played with Joe countless times. I know his dad well, and you can only take people as you find them, and all the Fords for me have been lovely, sort of lovely, genuine blokes. So I can't really comment on anyone else's experiences with them, but every encounter I've had with all of them have been fantastic. I mean, I've shared changes with them and they're all top blokes. So maybe there's personality clashes with certain people, but I obviously haven't seen or witnessed any of that type of stuff. So for me, just an all round good bloke.
Good stuff.
At 12, I went with Jimmy Gopeth. I think Jimmy's still will be fantastic. I think had he not been a Kiwi, he'd have had 50, 60, 70 caps at any other test playing country. Unfortunately, when he comes through and Dan Carter's at 10 and Marnoni's at 12, it's a tough ride. pretty tough gig. But I mean, Jimmy at Falcons was fantastic.
Like wine, isn't he? Just keeps getting better every single year.
Yeah. And this is the thing, like, obviously, everyone will say, well, it's easy to look good at Newcastle and what have you. When he goes to Wasps, it'll be different. And then became the best player at Wasps. And they all, well, they've got Cipriani now, and Jimmy's still the best player.
I mean, he was a Premiership Golden Boot winner for the Falcons in the relegation year. So he's
exactly.
He was a fantastic player.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, like, people say, oh, he's getting older now, and he's still probably their best player on the team. I think he plays 10, plays 12, plays 15. I mean, I've never been probably more impressed by playing and training alongside a player. I think he's absolutely fantastic. At 13, I went with Manu. Obviously, another player I played England age group with. Again, another man child. He was a man at 14 or 15, and we used to be genuinely at sort of 16. Most people were terrified to play against him. You'd sort of play Leicester Academy games, and they're all Leicester, typically quite big lads. And then you'd see Manu, where he couldn't roll his socks up because his calves were that bloody big. And just, yeah, I mean, yeah, what more needs to be said about him? Fantastic player. On the wing, I went with Jonah Holmes. I played with Jonah at Leeds and an age group, and he did well going to Leicester and broke into the Wales squad. Jonah's fantastic, electrically quick. I think he'll get more caps now he's gone to Newport next season. Really, really talented player. One of those guys who looks like they're jogging but runs past everyone and doesn't often break sweat, doesn't often break strides. Just sort of play makes it quite effortless, which is it's good to watch. It's not very good when you're playing against them, but when you're on their team, you just shout support as he makes a line break and you're sort of busting a gut to get up near him. On the other wing, I went with Christian Wade. For a guy to be, I think he's second or third Premiership try scorer of all time and only played till he was 27, says everything about how good attacking-wise he is. I think he's been dealt a very bum deal with England to not get senior caps, because when you're scoring the amount of tries that he did, I think it probably tells you something they might be missing.
Yeah.
Obviously, gone to American football now and looks, hopefully, fingers crossed, looks like he's going to get in the full squad at Buffalo for next year, which would be, would be absolutely amazing to go and take on a sport as big as American football. And, I mean, his first, everyone saw, went viral type thing, went saw his first touch of a ball and he's run it 70 yards in for a touchdown.
Yeah, that's incredible.
I think it's hard to comprehend, like, obviously how big a sport American football is and how many people try and become American footballers and fail. And then you get this kid from Northwest London, he says, there's a ball, all right, go carry it. And he runs it 70 yards in. It's just like, just off the scale. So I really, really hope he gets in the starting 52 squad or 53 man squad for next year. And then at fullback, I went with Elliot Daly, which is also a pretty self-explanatory one. I mean, the guy, he used to kick him off the tee 60 metres when he was 18, as well as every other facet of his game, which is pretty outrageous, isn't it?
That's a hell of a team.
Yeah, it's not bad. A bit of a show-off team. I felt like I should have mixed up and not tried to be show-off, but I don't think I could have put too many other players in there ahead of any of those lads.
I think what we're going to do is throughout the series, as we record more and more, we're going to get everybody's ultimate 15s together and just fight it out for who's best. So I think that's going to have a good shout.
Yeah, well, there's a few lads who've done all right in their careers, haven't they? I don't think too many of them have done badly.
But excellent. Well, thanks very much, Ollie, for coming on. It was good to chat through your history and some interesting stories in there.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Thanks ever so much for having me, guys. It's been a pleasure.
And we're going to launch officially next week, so you will be the first. So we'll keep you up to date with everything, and hopefully we'll speak soon.
Okay, cheers. Thanks ever so much, guys.
Ollie, all the best.
Cheers, bud. Bye-bye. Cheers.
You too. Thank you ever so much. Bye-bye.
So that's it for episode one, guys. Thanks very much for listening. If you enjoyed the episode, please follow the Northern Rugby Podcast on Twitter to hear about future episodes. You can listen to all of our episodes on the Anchor Podcast app, as well as the Anchor Podcast website, or you can subscribe to the Northern Rugby Podcast YouTube channel, as we will also upload all of our episodes on there too. We'll provide all the links necessary, no matter which platform you follow us on. We'll see you guys next time.